Welcome to Conversations with the Wise, insights and practices for difficult times. My name is James Barras, founder and teacher of the Awakening Joy course at awakeningjoy.info. If you're having trouble staying clear and positive in these crazy times, you're not alone. I'm asking some of today's most beloved wisdom teachers to share their insights and practices to help us retain clarity and calm in the midst of all the chaos and distraction in our world. For more information on this series and to see videos of these conversations, visit awakeningjoy.info and click on Conversations with the Wise. And now, here's our conversation. Enjoy. Well, hi, Guy, and everyone who might be watching this. I want to introduce you to anyone who might not know you. This is Guy Armstrong, a dear friend and colleague, and one of the most respected teachers in our insight meditation community. Certainly, somebody who I consider a wise person, and I'll just mention a few things about you. You are the author, see I pulled up the book here, of Emptiness, a Practical Guide for Meditators, which is really a fine piece of work, a really excellent book that I've enjoyed and lots of practitioners have been really getting a lot out of. And really one of the main forces that's guided Spirit Rock over these last 20 plus years, and also a guiding teacher of Insight Meditation Society. You got pretty good credentials.
Okay. Thank you, James, for the introduction. Appreciate it.
So as I said to you, Guy, I just want to have these conversations with some of the wonderful friends that I have about any thoughts and wisdom about navigating through these really crazy times that we're in. I guess it's always been crazy times in some ways, but this last year seemed to be a bit off the charts, and I don't know if it's going to be changing anytime soon. So. So that's the premise of where I'm coming from. I'm not looking. If you have all the right answers, I'm very, very eager to hear. But I'm just expecting just for us to explore together. Sound okay?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
So one of the first thoughts that comes to my mind is how does your Dharma practice help you navigate and stay sane when every day there's jaw-dropping news and a new bar for bewilderment and what goes on when you read the news or click the hyperlinks? Does your practice support you?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and one that I ask myself all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I have a number of different strategies for dealing with it. It is upsetting. It has been upsetting. Can I say, frankly, ever since the election?
You can be as frank as you want.
Okay.
We're going for the truth here.
Yeah. You know, I really, I was tremendously shocked and upset by the results of November 2016. I felt it was one of the worst days of my life, actually, the way that unfolded. And it felt very threatening for the welfare of the planet, number one, because of the urgency of the climate situation, mm-hmm. and very threatening for many of the most vulnerable members of the human family, women, people of color, gay and lesbian people, transgender people, poor people in general, elderly, and you name who's vulnerable, and there didn't seem to be much of a heart for their concerns. So it was very saddening, and it continues to reverberate in those ways as I've gone on. So I think the overall way I look at it is on two sides. One is external, one is internal. Mm-hmm. On the external side, I keep looking at what can I do with my limited individual human powers and responsibilities to make an actual difference. Mm-hmm. And all the ways seem small, but they seem important. So, you know, the usual thing about signing petitions, writing letters, donating to causes that are moving in the right direction. Of course, getting out and vote and supporting those movements, showing up for marches when it's important that voices be heard. I think all those things are important, not only for the wider society and keeping our bonds together, mm-hmm. but also for me personally and individually. It's one way that I can feel not victimized. Mm. When I don't feel like I have any response in a situation, I feel more powerless and more victimized. And if I take some external steps, it helps me feel that I can make even a tiny contribution. That's helpful. Mm-hmm. And then the other way is internally. Shall I just keep going a bit?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. One thing I'll just mention what you just, as you were just saying, that making that response, it reminds me of Angelus Arian's line that I love, that action absorbs anxiety.
It's, that too.
Saying that that urge that or that feeling of helplessness to actually do something.
Yeah, and I think of it also in terms of meditation. When we're assailed by afflictive emotions and, you know, fear or sadness, grief, etc., if we just have to feel we're at the effect of them, I think they feel more devastating. But through meditation, we get so many wonderful tools, you know, both mindfulness and loving kindness and compassion, to respond to afflictive emotions. It gives us a way to feel that we have some agency. And I think that's really important.
Mm. Let me ask you, just following that up. So when you get activated, so you get outraged or frustrated, and how do you access a wise response and attitude? And any suggestions that you would give anyone who might be watching this?
Yeah, well, that was kind of the other side of it, because I feel every day that I read the news, I feel an outrage at what's going on. You know, undermining the institutions and the agencies that we've put in place to care for our earth, our environment, our clean water, air, everything is at risk every day. So I'm feeling the need to continually restabilize and refine that inner balance. So a few things mm-hmm. that I'll mention. First of all, I am eternally grateful for the practice itself, because the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha really are our refuges. And to me, they've never seemed as real and vital as they do now. We have to use the teachings to keep finding our own inner place of balance and equanimity. So for me, continuing the formal meditation practice mm-hmm. is important. Reading the Dharma is still very central to my life, because it really provides a timeless viewpoint. You know, the Buddha lived through huge social changes of a son killing his father, who was the king, of warring kingdoms around his hometown in northern India, people who tried to kill him and cause him harm. So he was not immune from outward political craziness. And, you know, it was part of his life. And yet he managed to find an inner equilibrium in the middle of it all. So I think through our own meditation tools, we can find that. Also, so formal sitting continues to be an important piece. Reading Dharma is an important piece to restore faith, continued with faith. Another thing that I reflect on is, I don't know how to cast it exactly, perspective. Gaining perspective has been really important to me because I go through my day and I feel, you know, there's this kind of background anxiety or heaviness or worry about the country and the earth. And yet there are many moments of the day that aren't so touched by that. Mm-hmm. And so just appreciating the times when joy and friendship and the beauty of nature and the amazing opportunities we've had in this life come through that aren't touched by what's happening at the level of the federal government. So in a way, it's a little bit of the impermanence of the situation. How many moments of the day are actually impacted by the actions of the federal government. Mm-hmm. And there are many moments that for me are not. So appreciating that.
And letting yourself be nourished by those moments gives it a bit of space and perspective on things.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And so sort of in line with that, when I find I'm getting too obsessed by thinking about all the crazy stuff that's going on in the political world, mm-hmm. I try to step back from it in a couple of ways. One is sometimes I will take a fast from reading the news or listening to the news. Mm-hmm. And I only do it for a day or two, mm-hmm. but just clear some space in my mind so that it's not as oppressive. Mm-hmm. The other thing I do when I'm going through my day and meditating as well, I made a vow at the start of the year to renounce political papancha. And papancha is a Pali term, you know, mm-hmm. as you know, it means proliferation of thought, mm-hmm. That can free associate in many different directions, on and on and on. What we come to understand about papancha is that most of it is not that useful. Mm-hmm. So these are thoughts that really serve no discernible purpose, either for my life or for the welfare of the world. And when I find my mind going in that direction, which it often will after I've been reading news, mm-hmm. I just say, there's no point in this. Mm-hmm. If it's not going to lead me to take an action on behalf of the planet mm-hmm. or the people on the planet, mm-hmm. then I don't need to go down that road of just stirring myself up more about what's going on. Mm. So I'm trying to get more and more skilled at recognizing when political thinking is turning into needless proliferation and let it go.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the strategies of the Buddha where he says when you're getting caught up in distracting thoughts that you might just reflect and say, oh, where is this leading to? And do I really want to continue down that path?
Yeah. There's a lot of emphasis in the discourses on the quality he called wise attention, mm-hmm. and correspondingly unwise attention. And he basically said that when we place our attention in areas that just lead to further upset with no discernible positive value, mm-hmm. it's not a good use of our time. And then it's much better to come back to the areas he called wise attention, which is understanding what leads to happiness, what leads to unhappiness.
Easier said than done sometimes, but
yeah,
makes a lot of sense.
I'm really trying to apply that.
That's
and
good.
Watch where my attention goes when there's no fruitful outcome to it.
Let me ask you one of the famous discourses that the Buddha gives, where if somebody is hurting you, even sawing off your limb, you should refrain from hatred. And anyone who's done loving kindness practice knows that sometimes we call up a difficult person for us as a way to develop a kind heart and a goodwill towards them. Any thoughts about how to work with that when people in the news, our our fearless, unfortunately, very fearless leader, thin-skinned leader, or others are doing things that are causing harm to others. How do you keep from getting into hatred and ill will?
Yeah, that's a tough question. In leading meditations on loving kindness in retreat, we get to the category of the difficult person, you know, as you know, and people will often ask, well, what about this politician or that politician? Mm-hmm. I actually think, personally, I find it really difficult to work with them in terms of loving kindness for the difficult person, because I don't have a personal connection to them or a personal feel for them. Mm-hmm. When I'm working with a difficult person that I know in loving kindness, I can usually see some of their good qualities. Mm-hmm. And I ask myself, well, how would their mother look at them to feel love? And I can sort of get that. Mm-hmm. But when I look at politicians on the national stage, I don't see their humanity mm-hmm. often. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it's not just the president, but it's all the senators and representatives who I think are basically lying about a lot of the legislation that they're putting forward to deceive, you know, their own constituents. I have a hard time feeling actual metta for them. But then I come back to equanimity, which is that I really believe that they will reap the fruits of their actions. That lying is an unwholesome activity, lack of compassion, cruelty is an unwholesome activity, and that will come back in their lives to their detriment. So in a way, I don't feel that I have to hate them, because their own actions are going to take care of them.
Mm-hmm. They'll get what they deserve. One thing I'll just jump in. Since I asked the question that I do, and I often share this when people talk about having goodwill for the difficult or wishing them well, wishing, you know, you say may you be happy and may you live with ease. That if I'm thinking of it, oh, may they enjoy their life the way they are, that just doesn't compute, because they're hurting people. But if I wish for them to really understand where happiness lies, where the highest happiness lies, then in my perspective, they won't be hurting people if they really get where happiness lies. So may they wake up to see the truth of where well-being truly resides.
Nice.
I'm not holding my breath on it, but at least I can wish that for them.
You can wish it, yeah. And it feels good to wish it, wish it for them. And the other thing I wanted to toss in about trying to maintain perspective, renouncing political papancha, going on periodic news fasts helped me maintain some perspective. But the other thing, this has kind of surprised me. After the election, I got really interested in reading about history because I wanted to put this historical period in some kind of greater context. Because it was so shocking, so dramatic, and seemed basically so wrong. So I've read, since that time, I've read histories of England and Rome. Rome covering the empire time, England was covering the whole thing, and historical fiction about other empires in Asia and the Middle East. And one of the things that becomes clear from reading histories that cover extended periods of time is that every society that I've read about has gone through real periods of convulsion periodically, you know, not necessarily just once, but periodically through the history. And as periods of convulsions go, this one we're in right now is not the worst. I think about our parents going through World War II. when, you know, the real possibility of Europe being completely taken over by Nazi Germany was a very real one. And until the U.S. entered, you know, the possibility of Japan taking over most of Eastern Asia was a very real possibility also. Mm-hmm. So we aren't at that stage yet where millions and millions of lives are being lost through the violence of war. So I put it in that perspective. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I just came upon reading a history of England was this period around 1500. In the early 1500s, two things were happening simultaneously that had to kind of do with technology. One was the invention of the printing press by Gutenberg, mm-hmm. which happened in the 1400s. And the other was the translation of the Bible into English, mm-hmm. which happened in the early 1500s. The combination of those two, it's kind of interesting. Up to then, the dispensing of the word of the Bible was kept very controlled in the hands of the ecclesiastical elite, mm-hmm. because they had it in Latin, and they were the only ones who could read Latin, and so therefore they dispensed the religious teachings, which are a big authority at that time, mm-hmm. to the masses. But with the invention of the press and the translation of the Bible into English, all of a sudden, millions of people in England could read the Bible. And this was happening throughout Europe as well. This coincided with Martin Luther and the 95 Theses that led to the Protestant Reformation. Mm-hmm. So what happened was a huge erosion of the power of information, which had been tightly controlled. And as it, you know, was unleashed on the masses, you might say, there were big explosions all across England and Europe as the result of that. And I think of that a little bit like the effect of Twitter and Facebook on the last election. So when these new technologies come along, they are often lead to dramatic upheaval, and it doesn't settle down maybe for 100 years. Mm. Although, you know, you look at England, that change in the 1500s kind of led into and prepared for the Civil War that happened in the 1600s, where, again, there was a huge convulsion of the whole society with deaths, family members being on opposite sides of the war against each other, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of deaths across the country. So I think we may be in another period like this where the technological changes mm-hmm. are really largely responsible for this kind of convulsion. You look at the shifts of manufacturing due to globalization, that's another piece of the technological picture. And it may take us 50 years for this to settle down. I don't think we've seen the end at all of the technological change and the impact it's having on working men and women. So it may take a long time for this one to settle out. And this is the last thing that I want to say. I know I've been doing a lot of talking. Mm. Last thing I want to say is I really reflect on the power of patience. Mm-hmm. Patience, to me, as a Buddhist virtue and one of the paramis, is really about how do we maintain a balance of mind, or I'd even say a sweetness of mind, in conditions that are distinctly unpleasant. Mm-hmm. So part of it is the inner practices of meditation and Dharma that we're familiar with. And the other part is reflecting that this too will pass. Mm-hmm. This particular convulsion will settle out. Mm-hmm. I hope it's in time to save the planet, mm-hmm. to save the climate of the planet in a reasonable fashion. I know there are going to be many, many species deaths before that happens, but in a reasonable fashion to spare as many people as possible from suffering, that the political convulsions will in time settle out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and often, as you're saying about the convulsions, just like on a retreat, sometimes you have to go through really dark periods in order to see the light. And so convulsions also lead to a new way of seeing things if you can get through it, like Andrew Harvey has this line, just like the dark night of the soul that that meditators or spiritual journey is inherent in the spiritual journey, that we're going through a dark night of the species, and this has the potential to wake us up from an unsustainable situation right now. So
And we may already be seeing some signs of you might call it a renaissance in the elections that happened this November. Mm-hmm. The way that so many people were inspired to run for office and so many people were inspired to work for the election of younger, committed, conscious candidates, as you really see playing out in Virginia. Mm-hmm. For example, and all the positive energy that got brought into being and released through mm-hmm. that struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know for myself and so many people, I've not felt as patriotic in my lifetime. I think since JFK, just that I realized, I really love the ideals of this country, and there's so many people who are all of a sudden waking up to seeing how much they care about the values that that we were taught growing up and really want to keep them alive. So it's interesting how that can how the hard stuff can lead to a new possibility. Actually, that reminds me of something I wanted to share with ask of you. In your better moments, what would be the most positive vision for the future that could come out of all of this?
Well, I think that it's possible that this could really bring about a sense of unity among a lot of groups that were, you might say, on the cutting edge of change, in recent years, who have seemingly been marginalized by the current administration. Mm. But I think about all the environmentalists who are working so hard. I think about the benefit to the whole society from the greater participation of women, because I think women bring a more nurturing approach to taking care of humanity than male politicians have been showing. The coming into greater visibility of people of color and the cultures that they come from, the contributions by indigenous people, like we saw at Standing Rock. You know, Standing Rock was in a way a symbol of how the different groups, the progressive groups, could come together and really stand together for something that was important. Mm-hmm. So I think the possible great benefit is the unification among all the different groups that share at least aspects of a common vision of inclusivity, an appreciation for the diversity of our people.
Mm-hmm. That's a lovely way to hold it.
What do you think, James?
Well, I also think, I think it's kind of like, here we are in this unsustainable way of living as a species on this planet. Whether it's climate change or consumption, it's just it can't keep on going on. So we're reaching a kind of breaking point, and something has had to happen to stop this continued momentum. So in some ways, the craziness and the chaos and the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion really coming into clear sight, so that everybody can see. It's like the last gasp of those forces, and unfortunately, it will be it means that there is a lot of suffering that, that will happen. But in some ways, it's a, you know, if it's not too crass to say it, a kind of reboot to the whole system, that humanity is facing. As I often quote our friend Roger Walsh, who says we're in a race between fear and consciousness, and who knows if there's enough time, but consciousness, there's never been as much consciousness as there is now on the planet, especially with information technology and all. So I'd like to think, until proven otherwise, that we're heading in the direction of more and more consciousness that will rise to meet all the dukkha, all the suffering that we're facing. And there's a potential here for waking up in a way that there hasn't been before. And just going through the sleepwalking, we were going to be, you know, like the frog that's slowly cooking and doesn't realize it. And here, like the water has gotten hot really fast, and we're jumping out of the pan and saying, "Wait, we've got to try it that way." So, in my better moments, that's what I see we're in the process of.
Yeah, and what you're really pointing to there is a growth in spiritual perspective, spiritual understanding. That humanity could take a real move forward in due to the conditions right now, and that would really help to unify all the different conflicts that are going on.
Lastly, this kind of brings me to something I was thinking about. You're just touching on. I'm remembering Arnold Toynbee, the great historian, who said that that looking back on the 20th century, he thought that perhaps one of the most significant developments would be Buddhism coming to the West. Actually, he said he thought it might be the most significant development. And, you know, it seems both amazing and prescient and maybe a stretch, but for me, I think that's so, with the mindfulness everywhere and this whole, whether you call it Buddhism or the Dharma or consciousness, coming to the masses at this time. And I'm just wondering, in your thought, what does the Dharma, what perspective, or what are the teachings that, as the general population understands more and more, how can it make a difference and be that significant development?
Well, of course, you know, it's coming into a culture that has a very established religion. In the West, that's mostly Christianity. So I don't really see it overtaking Christianity in terms of influence anytime, you know, soon. But even little by little, I think some of the values of Buddhism may be coming through. What I think stands out about Buddhism in the, you know, context of world history since its origin 2,500 years ago is that it's a way of looking at the human situation that has a very strong spiritual dimension, but the one that doesn't rest on beliefs or dogma. So in that way, it seems to me, it's really attuned to the scientific worldview that is, you know, a very strong element within Western thought, that it's to me, the most likely form of spirituality suited to the Western scientific mind, because it doesn't ask for belief in anything supernatural. It basically says, you know, as you and I have talked about many times, come and see for yourself. Check this out and see if it works in your experience. So it's very practical. And yet it has a vast spiritual reach. And one of the things it rests on are the precepts and compassion.
Living
with integrity and kindness and compassion. So if those started to become living part of more and more people's view of the world, without being clouded by fundamentalist ideology from any direction, that could be a really powerful force for good. You know, how far that will go, I have no idea. But that's what I see as the potential for the Dharma in this age.
And for me, one additional piece that's particularly such an inherent part in the teachings is the fact that everything is part of everything else, and that the you can't separate out us and them when you really see it in that perspective, what sometimes is called interconnectedness or whatever word you want to use, and just to see that we're all part of the same system, and somehow that tendency to create other and the whole divisiveness, if you can see through it and see, oh, we're all like Buckminster Fuller said, we're all passengers on spaceship Earth, that once you have that kind of perspective, it does shift things from, every man for himself to, we've got to work together on this.
Yeah. And I think that's the real meaning of inclusivity. You know, we talk about inclusivity as a politically correct ideal, but I think the deep meaning of it is that spiritual understanding that we're all basically the same being. The humans are all basically the same beings, and the animals are not very far away either.
Well, we're all in this together.
Yeah.
Any last words thoughts on the topic that you'd like to leave people with?
Well, you know, the Dalai Lama is fond of saying that he's an optimist, and he's lived through some incredibly difficult upheavals of culture, and he still sees the damage being done. And yet he still has the biggest smile and the biggest laugh that I know of in the world. So I have to say, I'm an optimist also. And I have no doubt that we're going to get through these next 3 years, and something different is going to start happening.
Sounds good. I'll meditate to that.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Guy.
All right, James. It's nice to hang out with you, buddy.
Same here. Take care.
Okay. Yeah.
You've been listening to Conversations with the Wise, Insights and Practices for Difficult Times. For more information on this series and to see the video of this and other conversations, please visit awakeningjoy.info and follow the links. We'd love to hear from you, so please follow us on Facebook and YouTube and let us know what you think. And please like and share the videos. Till next time, this is James Barras wishing you true well-being and a caring, loving connection with the world.